Everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabel, Missouri. The Law Hour is an education service in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 75 countries around the world over the internet. So for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please go to the webpage georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. And the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report. Is your retirement at risk when we come back? You know, when you're making $50,000 a year, you're paying $7,650 in Social Security taxes. Then, in addition to that, you pay a 17% income tax on that same $50,000. Now, that's another $8,500, which means that you pay an extra $1,300 by paying your tax on a tax. Well, that makes the real effective Social Security tax rate 17.8%. It's not the 15.3% that's advertised. Now, isn't that real neat? For more information about tax and status, why don't you call the law school at 417-273-4967. Help take a bite out of crime. Call and ask for my free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative. Best of all, it's free. That number again, 417-273-4967. Now, tax and status of school is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, go to the website georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Click onto the email, send an email request for that free general law CD package. Do it right now before you forget. Remember, georgegordon.org, or call direct, 417-273-4967. All right, last time I said we'd take a look at the housing boom. Remember, when you take a look at the evening news, watch Jim Laird. Next time they have a segment on the economy, they'll tell you that unemployment is great at 5%. Remember, that's a lie. It's really closer to 10 or 12%. They tell you about inflation. It's running at 4.3%. That's a lie. It's running at 10%. Then they tell you about the economy is growing 3.4% a year. That's a lie. It's contracting at nearly 1% a year. And then they tell you that housing prices are strong and that there's no bubble and that we're going onward and upward with the housing boom. And it's not just in the United States. This housing boom is worldwide. It isn't just the United States economy that is going bonkers over real estate prices. It's Spain and Ireland. It's not Germany and Japan, but it's Britain and Holland and other countries in Europe. And the prices around the world in other countries, just like the United States, is stabilizing and keeping those economies from going bust. Well, that's good. It'll stave off the inevitable for another week or 10 days or 2 months or 2 years, but the inevitable is, in fact, the inevitable. Wouldn't it be a lot better if we could look into the future and say, you know, the Titanic is going to hit an iceberg and it's going to sink and kill a lot of people? How could we prevent that from happening? Should we put more lifeboats on the ship? Should we steer south? Should we slow down? You know, there were a lot of things that should have been done in hindsight that were not done. And when it was all said and done, there were 1,500 people dead and a lot of weeping and wailing going on. The same thing can be true when we talk about World War II, any of the great events of history. Looking back on them in hindsight, we say, oh my God, you know, it would have been a whole lot better if we could have avoided World War I or World War II or Vietnam. Boy, it sure would have been nice if we could have avoided the Great Depression of the 1930s. What did we need to do? What did we fail at that produced these kinds of events? Well, most people would look at it and say, well, it's just caprice. It's just chance. It's just the way the cookie crumbled. No, boys and girls, history is caused by cause and effect. There's a cause for every effect. And when you break a law, there's an effect that comes from it. You know, if you want to play sodomite, the natural penalty for that is early death. Sodomites die between 39 and 45 on average. They don't live to be 75 years old. They don't live to be 70 years. There's a cause and effect relationship there. And sexual misconduct results in sexually transmitted diseases, you know, like AIDS, herpes, and VD. Cause and effect. Same thing is true in economics. There's a cause and effect relationship that goes along with the violation of economic laws. And the world is involved in a great crime spree as it relates to economics. And the great crime spree is the violation of the economic laws of the Bible, like thou shalt not steal, which is supported by a collateral law that says you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. And so we woke up one day and said, oh no, God's got that all wrong. Why, we need to have stocks and bonds and negotiable instruments and mortgages and second deeds of trust to make profit and gain and stimulate the economy. Okay, but now you've got stocks and bonds and you've got Federal Reserve notes and mortgages and second deeds of trust and you're stimulating the economy. And you get this boom-bust cycle. You see, you've had it through the 20th century. You had this boom bust cycle. In 1907 was a bust, and then 1922 was a bust, 29 to 36 was a bust, and then you had a bust in 48, a bust in 68, a bust in 79, a bust in 92, and we call these recessions. Well, there's an economic law that requires a jubilee and a land Sabbath, that requires the forgiveness of debts every 7 years. There's an entire economic law that nobody has ever heard of, nobody knows anything about. And it's the violation of that economic code or that economic system that causes this boom-bust cycle. Now we're down to the wire. Boy, were we in for a rude awakening when this economy collapses worldwide. It's not just the United States, so you can forget about I'll escape to Mexico or I'll split and run to Europe or I'll go to Asia. They're all in this together. All the nations of the world are in a race to the bottom. And as the United States inflates its currencies, the other nations, to keep their currencies from appreciating, they're inflating their currencies to keep them lower so that they won't suffer from an export price increase. Well, okay. And as this race to the bottom continues on, there comes a point in time when we're going to actually reach the bottom. We're not there yet, but we're on our way. And of course, there's this new world order. And when this new world order is ushered in on the ashes of the old world's economy, when everybody is weeping and wailing and they're just at their wits' end, the bankers will come along with a solution. They're the cause of the problem and they've got a solution to the problem. And they'll come along and say, we need a new color of paper money. We need a cashless society. We need identification. We need to protect you from identity theft and all of these evils that are going on around us. Well, one of the evils that's going on around us is rampant speculation. This rampant speculation in housing, like the rampant speculation in tobacco land in the 1840s in the United States, and the tulip mania. There have been manias going on in the world for hundreds of years. So what's going on today isn't anything new. It's been going on for hundreds and probably thousands of years. Let's take a look at housing. The worldwide rise in house prices is the biggest bubble in history. So you can prepare for the economic pain when it pops. Never before have real house prices risen so fast or for so long or in so many countries. Property markets have been frothing from America, Britain, Australia, France, Spain, China. Rising property prices helped to prop up the world economy after the stock market bubble burst in 2000. What if the housing boom now turns to a bust? Then what? Well, according to estimates by The Economist, the total value of residential property in developed economies rose by more than $30 trillion over the past 5 years. It's now over $70 trillion, an increase equivalent to 100% of those countries' combined GDPs. Now, not only does this dwarf any previous house price boom, it is larger than the global stock market bubble in the late 1990s. An increase over 5 years of 80% of GDP, or America's stock market bubble in the late 1920s, 55% of GDP. In other words, it looks like the biggest bubble in the history of the world. God, you get to think of it, you get to live right through it. I remember the stock market bubble of the 90s, and Alan Greenspan was talking about exuberance. He said, how was it he worded that? He said, illicit or unwarranted exuberance. Fortunately for me, I didn't have any money invested in the market, but Americans lost $7 trillion of value, just wiped away. And of course, that ruined a lot of people. Some people just lost a bunch of money, but some people actually were ruined by it. And I suspect that that's what's coming with the real estate bubble. You know, it's one thing to buy and sell stocks. It's another thing to get involved in this mania. And buying and selling property is one thing, but getting involved in the mania that's involved with it, that's something else. Well, the global boom in house prices has been driven by two common factors. Historically low interest rates, which have encouraged home buyers to borrow more money, and households have lost faith in equities after the stock markets plunged in 2000. It makes property look very attractive by comparison. Will prices now fall or will they simply flatten out? And in either case, what will be the consequences for economies around the world? The likely answers to all of these questions are not very comforting. The increasing importance of house prices in the world economy prompted The Economist to start publishing a set of global house price indices in 2002. These now cover 20 countries using data from lending institutions, estate agents, and national statistics. Our latest quarterly update shows that home prices continue to rise by 10% or more in half of the countries. America has been one of the biggest increases in house price inflation over the past year, with the average price of homes jumping by 12.5% in the year-to-year first quarter. In California, Florida, Nevada, Hawaii, Maryland, and Washington, D.C., they soared by more than 20%. So they're keeping track of house prices in South Africa, Hong Kong, Spain, France, New Zealand, the United States, Denmark, Sweden, China, Italy, Belgium, Ireland, Britain, Canada, Singapore, Netherlands, Switzerland, Australia, Germany, and Japan. 20 countries around the world. And boy, there are some very impressive increases like 12%. I mentioned in the last program, can you point to anything that's increased in price 4.3%? What I see is gasoline and housing prices and gold and silver and food and plywood. Whenever I take a look at the increase in prices, they're all 10, 15, 20%. And at bare minimum, they're 5, 6, 8, 9%. I can't think of anything that's only increased in price by 4.3% over the past year. If there is an item or two, and I'm sure there probably is, I'm pretty sure that they're in the minority. So what's happening here is that the Bureau of Labor Statistics is cooking the books, like Arthur Anderson cooked the books on Enron. So what we're seeing now is the United States government cooking the books. In fact, the Federal Reserve isn't even hiding it. The M3 money indicator is going to be abolished on March 23rd, 2006. In other words, one of the monetary indicators that economists use to keep track of the economy and money expansion and inflation, which is the M3 money supply, the Federal Reserve says, we're going to quit publishing that. I don't blame them. If I had as bad a numbers and as bad a report as the M3 money supply, I'd want to shut it off too. But it tells me a story. Whenever I see fine print, it tells me a story. Whenever I see somebody telling me that they're not going to tell me that information anymore, that tells me a story. And then I react accordingly. I know how to deal with M3. If you don't want to tell me how much you're inflating the economy, then I know you're inflating the economy a whole lot more than what you're admitting to. And they're admitting to 4.3%. So I know it's a whole lot more than that. In fact, the numbers, when we crunch the numbers, tell us that they're inflating the money supply by 6%. 7.3% I saw in one recent week. That's running year on year about 6%. Now, when you're increasing the money supply by 6%, then there's another indicator, how much is the credit supply being increased? See, that's where the Fed is printing more $100 bills, and then they got the banks out there that are fractionally reserving their lending practices, and so they're lending money, and that's on top of the money expansion. Then it's not just the United States that's doing it, it's the Chinese, the Japanese, and everybody else in the world. They're expanding and inflating their money supply also. Hey, that doesn't bode well for the future. Doesn't bode well for savings, doesn't bode well for future business indices either. And here's what goes on, and here's why inflation works so well. Because you actually end up with more dollars. That's what people want. They want more dollars. I don't want more dollars. I want fewer dollars. In fact, I have succeeded now in reducing my income. I no longer make $100,000 a year. I now make less than $7,000 a year. I just collected in gold coin. That's all. Years ago, I took a look at this, and I got to thinking about it. And I can remember back in the 60s and 70s when I got into the contracting business. I did a house out on 23rd Avenue in Oakland. And I bought the house for $12,000, sold it for $27,000. Of course, it cost me a few bucks to fix it up, but I made a little profit off of it. I bought it for $12,000, fixed it up, sold it for $27,000. And no doubt today, that house would probably sell for $100,000 today. And every time that house sells for more money, the assessor comes out and raises the taxes on it. Huh. I got to looking at that and I said, geez, no wonder your taxes keep going up. They keep inflating the money supply, and we want to buy the house for $12,000, sell it for $27,000. That guy wants to buy it for $27,000 and sell it for $45,000. And then that guy wants to buy it for $45,000 and sell it for $60,000. And that guy wants to buy it for $60,000 and sell it for $75,000. And this goes on. And the tax assessor sits back there grinning to himself, runs out there, takes a look at the house, and he reassesses the property value and keeps raising the taxes. And then the county government can keep spending more money on more nonsense, more pork. And the federal government does the same thing, and the state governments, everybody's in on the act. One day I woke up and said, geez, what I want to do is reduce it. I told you the story once before. I bought a piece of ground here not too long ago, and it sold for $26,000 back in 1990. And so I bought it for $6,400 in gold coin. I reduced its value. I'm waiting now for the county assessor to raise the taxes. He hasn't done it yet. Well, there isn't any reason to raise the taxes. The price didn't go up, it went down. And if we would deal in just weights and balances, if we would deal in gold and silver coin, which is what Article 1, Section 10, and our founding fathers, and Moses, and God, and everybody that was associated with hard money told us to do, we wouldn't have any inflation. But you know, it's a choice that we have to make. And the choice that we've made is we prefer Federal Reserve notes. We prefer stocks and bonds and negotiable instruments. We prefer paper over gold and silver coin. I mean, that's just the way life is. Well, at least the majority of Americans do. And, of course, the majority of Americans are suffering from inflation, and they have maxed out their credit cards, and they can't make their payments on their credit cards, so they make the minimum payments. And then they're cashing in on the equity of their houses. As it appreciates in value, they go down, they cash a little more out. They refinance and refinance and refinance, and they don't own anything. They haven't got a pot to piss in, a place to put it, or a window to throw it out of. That's the bottom line. Like I said, there's a cause and effect relationship that goes with it. Now we're on the border or on the verge of hyperinflation. Well, there's really no other choice. It's either deflation or hyperinflation, and we went through that deflation trip back in the 1930s, and everybody's terrified of deflation. So Our helicopter, Ben Bernanke, has informed us that we're going to have liquidity. We're going to have inflation. Well, inflation, when it reaches about 8% of GDP, is going to turn into hyperinflation. As we saw from the Figge report, it just took 3 days for hyperinflation to set in at 5,000% in Brazil. That's the last time they went through it. Now, this doesn't mean the end of the world is coming. I mean, the stock market bubble popped back in 1990, I guess it was 2000, 2001, and it was $7 trillion worth of losses. And when the housing bubble pops, there's going to be several trillion dollars worth of losses. And I intend to move in and make some money. I'm just sorry as hell for you people out there, but you know, business is business. There's nothing personal about this. But I'm not a net buyer of real estate right now. What I'm doing is sitting by watching you guys. I want to watch you guys make millions and millions of dollars in the real estate market when the bubble pops. And then I'll move into the market and I'll buy a piece of property or two. I'm not going to buy all the property in New York like Donald Trump. I'm just going to buy one or two when it reaches the bottom. And then I'll sit on that property as it appreciates in value in the next cycle. And that's the way the game is played. Buy low, sell high. Most people buy high, sell low, and make it up on volume. I don't like volume sales. I just do one or two deals at a time. And it's a wild new concept, a wild new idea. Now, a couple of years ago, for the past 2 or 3 years, I've been recommending to at least all my students that they sell their real estate. And of course, if you listened to me 3 years ago and you sold in 2002, well, then you missed the appreciation of 2003, 4, and 5. If you sold your property in June of 2005, you hit the market right at the peak. Because right now, since June, here in the United States, the price of real estate has been continually decreasing. Not by much, just a few percentage points. It's still increasing, but the rate of increase is slowed, and the number of houses on the market has increased dramatically. So you missed the top of the market, and now you have to deal with the buyers in a buyer's market, and now you have to discount your property. So the peak was reached in June. So if you sold 2 years ago, you made money. If you sold a year ago, you made more money. If you sold in June of 2005, you made even more money. Kind of reminds me of old Russell Harvey. He was in the stock market back in 1927. He sold out in 27. The market didn't collapse in 27, 28, and it was at the end of 29, and people laughed at him and made fun of him and said, "You fool, you blind, you sold," and the market went up and up and up after you sold. It did. Old man Harvey had bought in 1922 at the bottom, rode it up to the top. In 27, he sold about 15% below the market cap. Then when the market broke in October of 1929, it revived in 30 and 31, and you know, it bounces up and down like you see the stock market doing today. Finally, it bottomed out in 1935, and old man Harvey, who sold his stock for $2.73 a share in 1927, bought it all back again at $5 a share in 1935. Then he still had the stock, Bank of America shares, at $54 a share in 1954 or 53, $54 a share. Not bad, huh? That's what we call market timing. And after all, that's all that business is all about. It doesn't make any difference whether you're buying hula hoops or real estate or stocks and bonds or you're dealing in sesame seeds and wheat, corn, beans, onion, oil. The objective is to buy it when it's at a lower price than when you sell it. That's what real estate's all about. But manias don't deal in reason, logic, and common sense, buying tulips at astronomical prices at the top of the market. In other words, buying a house now at the top of the market and then hoping to sell it and to make a little bit more at a higher top and a higher top, now that's kind of risky. Old folks like me, we don't care too much for risk. We kind of like to have safe, secure investments. And that's why gold and silver right now are pretty safe, secure investments, because today gold is priced at about 1/4 of its real value. Silver is priced at about 1/25 of its real value. So that's why I recommend gold and silver, because it's already at historic lows. It's true, it's doubled in price over the last few years, but that's because it was so abysmally low. Same thing is true for other commodities, like oil. See, when you're reaching peak oil, right now you say, my God, oil is $60 a barrel. Hell, it'll be $600 a barrel here shortly. I mean, boys and girls, when you get into hyperinflation, we're talking about the sky is the limit. Now, let's go on here with our 20 countries around the world. The increasing importance of house prices in the world's economy prompted The Economist to start publishing a set of global house price indices in 2002. In Europe, prices have long been at dizzying heights in Ireland and Spain, but over the past year have also spurted at rates of 9% or more in France, Italy, Belgium, Denmark, and Sweden. Both France, 15%, and Spain, 15.5%, have faster house price inflation than the United States. Here in the States, it's about 12.5%. Now, by contrast, some housing booms have now fizzled out. In Australia, according to official figures, the 12-month rate of increase in house prices slowed sharply to only 0.4% in the first quarter of 2005, down from almost 20% in late 2003. Wishful thinkers call this a soft landing, but another index, calculated by the Commonwealth Bank of Australia, which is based on prices when contracts are agreed rather than at settlement, shows that average house prices have actually fallen by 7% since 2003. Prices in once red-hot Sydney have plunged by 16%. All right, so you Aussies down there are beginning to see prices soften and go down. That's the first thing that happens when the market reaches the top. It doesn't just disintegrate overnight. The rate of increase slows until it reaches zero, and then the rate of decrease begins to accelerate from 1%, 2%, 3%, 5%, and so on, until it reaches a bottom at some point in time. Now, nobody, to my knowledge, I've never met anybody who has ever sold at the top or bought at the bottom. I still have some $15 an ounce silver that I bought back in 1980. Or 81 or 2, long in there. See, when I saw the price of silver reach $50, I said, well, that's bubble high. So then it decreased, you know, to 25, and it kept going down, down, down. Pretty soon it got down to 15, and then it went up to 16, 17, 18, and then it went back down to 15, and it's just kind of stayed at 15 and 15 and 15 and 15 for a long time, and I said, well, that looks like the bottom. So I took some of my Federal Reserve notes, and I bought silver at the bottom at $15, and I've had that silver from 1985 to 2005. Hell, I've been sitting on it for 20 years. And I don't have a whole lot of it. I've got a lot of silver at $10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4. I think the cheapest that I can recall buying any silver was at about $4.50. When silver was bouncing around down at $4.50, $4.75, I just put an artificial ceiling on it at $5. And when you came to class here, I just gave people $5 an ounce. So I've got a few, a few coins at $5 and a few coins at $15. But here's the point. Today, silver is running at about 58-1, and the correct ratio is 16-1. So either one of two things, either silver at $8 and change is way underpriced compared to gold, or gold compared to silver is way overpriced. Truth of the matter is, both of them are underpriced compared to their historic highs in 1980. Now, if you take your paper money in 1980 and compare it with 2005, in 25 years, it's lost half its value. Half its value. The price of gold hit an abnormally high price of $870 in intraday trading in January of 1980. At that historic high, the price of gold should be over $2,000 an ounce. But if we adjust it for mania at $500 an ounce, it is simply where it was, or where it should have been in 1981, which was about $500 an ounce. That's fine. It's $500 an ounce today, but the paper money today buys half as much. So the correct price for gold is a minimum of $1,000 an ounce. So buying gold today at $500 an ounce is half price. Buy a bunch. And to buy silver at $8 an ounce, well, one of two things is true here. Either the price of gold is way overpriced compared to silver, or silver at $8 times 16 should be priced at $128, and it isn't. But it will be. There comes a point in time when silver and gold will come into equilibrium. That is, the price of silver and gold will come to 16-1. It happened three times in the 20th century. The pendulum swings in wild gyrations. But every time it swings, it hits the middle. And when it hits the middle, that's 16-1. That's where it's supposed to be. The correct price of silver right now today should be somewhere in the neighborhood of, let's take $500. Whoops, that's 5,000. So 500. Just divide that by 16. And the price of silver should be around $31.25 at today's price. Now, the price of silver is way undervalued. And when the pendulum swings, the price of silver will not go from $8 to $31.25. It'll go from $8 to $100 or $150, which will be way over what it's worth. And then the pendulum will swing back. And then it'll come back into equilibrium. It'll finally bottom out where it's supposed to at $31.25. Just mark my words. Let's see if that doesn't happen. It happened three times in the 20th century, and I predict it'll happen three more times in the 21st century. Let me give you a reminder here as we're talking about whatever happened to your retirement. And is your retirement at risk? Boy, I'll say it is. Your retirement not only is at risk, your retirement is going to be stripped away, just like it has been for millions of Americans already. And every retirement, every pension plan in America is going upside down. It's in the cards. Stand by. You're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, worldwide on the Internet. For more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. Remember, that's georgegordon.org. The Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, the Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school, and it is open to individuals by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. For more information, just go to the homeschooling page on our website at georgegordon.org. And also, the Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, and all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the internet by title and date for your listening convenience. The Law Hour is carried worldwide on the internet, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law Hour brings you timely reports on law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events 7 days a week. And the Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. To order yours, please call the Law School Direct at 417-273-4967. Remember, the CD package is free of charge. All you have to do is call and order it. The number again, 417-273-4967. Now, the opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine and mine alone. They don't necessarily represent the beliefs and opinions of our advertisers, sponsors, management, or staff of this network or local radio station. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, remember the webpage, georgegordon.org, or call direct 417-273-4967. Okay, we're talking about your retirement. Is it at risk? Well, most people's retirement is tied up in their homes. The biggest single purchase that you're going to make in your lifetime is your home. And the Federal Reserve came out and they put out some bait starting in about 2000, 2001. They lowered interest rates to record low numbers. Americans stopped savings and they took those record low interest rates, used their credit, they cashed out equity in their homes, and they spent the money on SUVs, swimming pools, and the high life. Over the last 5 years, we've been cashing out and just living it up. That's going to come back and bite us in the butt, boys and girls. That was a trap. You see, the debtor is servant to the lender. And everybody that has a debt on his house is going to wake up one day and he won't be able to service the debt, either the interest or the principal or both. And when that day comes, there's going to be a massive reorganization of property in America. And that property is going to go from you to somebody else. Your property is going to be taken away from you. That's the way that game is played. Now, there's a few guys out there that are cashing out their equities. For instance, I've mentioned this guy a time or two. I could tell you about 10 or 15 of them, but there was a guy up in New Jersey and just recently had a house for $226,000. He sold that house in New Jersey. He didn't own it free and clear. He just had an equitable interest in it. I think his equity was about $80,000 or $90,000, but he sold it, took his equity out, came down here to Ozark County. He bought a place for $65,000 and still had $20,000 in his pocket. I told him, hey, take your $20,000, invest it in this house, fix the things that need fixing, and then turn around and sell it. It'll sell for about $140,000. He didn't do that. But that's where money is made in real estate. It's sweat equity. It's where you actually own the thing free and clear. Then if the market bubble breaks, who cares? For instance, I'll give you a little illustration here. We have a farm here, and when it was bought many, many, many years ago, I think it sold for $250 an acre back in 1969. It went up to $1,000 an acre in 1979. Then it dropped back down to $250 an acre through the 1980s. It started rising in the 90s, and today it's probably worth $2,000 an acre, especially if you'd subdivide it into 5 and 10 acre parcels. It'll be worth $5,000 an acre. But we didn't do that. We didn't sell it. It's our inheritance, and we can't sell it because it would violate one of the economic laws of the scripture. So not wanting to violate the law of God, we just hang on to it. And now the price is right on the verge of collapsing, and it'll go back down to $250 an acre. But it doesn't mean anything because we own it free and clear. It isn't debt-ridden. Nobody's going to take it away from us when the market bubble pops. Now, if I'd have been thinking like normal people, I would have already gone to John Harlan, our local banker, and I would have borrowed everything I could against it, and I'd be making payments, and I would be using the bank's money until I couldn't service the debt anymore, and then the bank would repossess the property and then sell it to the next holder in due course. That's what's coming in America. That's what happened in the 1930s. That's what happened after the American Civil War. It's a process that's been going on between bankers and bond servants for thousands of years. The bankers lend to the bond servants. The bond servants overextend themselves. The bankers come in, take all of their equity away, and then come back and lend them more money to get them started again so that they can keep them in perpetual credit debt slavery. So you're just seeing here in the housing bubble an extension of perpetual credit debt slavery. That's what it boils down to. Credit cards and house prices. Well, Britain's housing markets also cooled rapidly. The nationwide index, which we use, rose by 5.5% in the year to May, down from 20% growth in July of 2004. But once again, other surveys offer a gloomier picture. The Royal Institution of Chartered Surveyors reports that prices have fallen for 10 consecutive months, with a net balance of 49% of surveyors reporting falling prices in May, the weakest number since 1992 during Britain's previous house price bust. The volume of sales has slumped by one-third compared with a year ago, as both sellers and buyers have lost confidence in house valuations. House price inflation has also slowed significantly in Ireland, the Netherlands, and New Zealand over the past year. By the way, this is an up-to-date report as of 12/4/05, so it's within a week. The most compelling evidence that home prices are overvalued in many countries is the diverging relationship between house prices and rents. The ratio of prices to rents is a sort of price-earnings ratio for the housing market, just as the price of a share should equal the discounted present value of future dividends. So the price of a house should reflect the future benefits of ownership, either as rental income for an investor or the rent saved by an owner-occupier. In single-family homes, the way we always traditionally measured the value of a house was to figure out how much will that house rent for today. If that house would rent for $300 a month, we would use a multiplier. 300 times 12 times 10 equals $36,000. That's what that house is worth. So what that tells me is that if I can rent it for $300 a month, in 10 years I can own that house. So I would take a house priced at $36,000 and I would put 10% down. That's $3,600. Then I would rent the house for $300 a month. The payment should be right around $300 a month. And for my work, that is repairing and renting and suffering the vacancies and going through all of the work and the heartache that goes with being a landlord, at the end of 10 years, my $3,600 would have multiplied into $36,000. So we take the $36,000 and we deduct $3,600 and we'd have $32,400. I would have gained $32,400, or about $3,200 a year in round numbers, $3,000 a year for 10 years. So my $3,000 investment would double itself and make me $3,000 every year, you know, in round numbers. It doesn't quite double every year, but it's getting right up there, close to 100% return. Now that is a real estate investment, a real estate investment. It's, to be sure, called a leveraged investment. But the $300 a month, remember, you're going to mortgage this house when you buy it for 30 years or 25 years or 20 years or 15 years. And in that period of time, that house has paid for itself. You've got a cash flow that comes out of it. And you've used your credit. And you've got an equity in the house. And the house will always rent for something. And if it doesn't rent for $300 a month, it'll rent for, oh, hell, $250 or $200. There's a cushion. But let me show you what happens with this real estate mania. In real estate mania, people are buying houses, and they're paying, oh, something on the order in San Diego, California, of $300,000-$500,000 for this house. And they're putting no money down, and they're taking the house on what they call an adjustable rate mortgage. They're called ARMs, A-R-M-S. That's called an adjustable rate mortgage. Now, they take the mortgage at 5%, but the mortgage can go up to 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 15, 20%. Depends on what the market will bear. Now, if things go right and he buys this house for, say, $400,000, and it goes up in value by $100,000 over the next, you know, 2-3 years, and he can sell that house, even if he never rented it, even if he just paid out the money, he makes a profit on it. That doesn't have anything to do with investment, boys and girls. That has everything to do with speculation. Speculation has everything to do with gambling. Gambling has nothing to do with business. Businessmen don't gamble. I'm a businessman, not a gambler. When I invest money, I make money. I make a profit each and every time. Otherwise, I don't invest my money. Now, it is true. It is true. You can invest your money, and sometimes the market goes contrary to your expectations, and you lose money. Well, let me assure you, boys and girls, it doesn't have anything to do with gambling. What people are doing today is just plain gambling. I prefer, when I gamble, the crap table. And the reason for that is I don't have to put up near as much money. You know, I don't have to put up $400,000 over, say, a period of 2 or 3 years to get an outcome. I mean, I can put $200 or $300 on the pass line and throw the dice and get an outcome and get a decision in 30 seconds. And each time the croupier pays me or takes my money, I can put up another bet, throw the dice. Hell, I can bet on somebody else throwing the dice. I can make a bet every throw of the dice. Hell of a lot more exciting. And the risk is a lot less. I mean, you got less than a 1% risk on every throw of the dice. I can put $300 on the pass line, and I can just do that all night, and I'm only going to lose 1%. In fact, it'll be 0.5%. So if you want to gamble, the crap table is the best buy in the pass, and don't pass lines are the place to gamble. If you want to invest, then that's another story. And there aren't any investments in the Dow Jones Industrial Averages or in the NASDAQ. All you got to do is do the arithmetic. There's no money to be made there. Now, when I buy real estate, and I buy the real estate correctly, and this is where we're going to buy a lot of real estate at distressed prices, and it won't be very much longer. So if you're sitting on some real estate, and if you can be lucky enough to unload that real estate, convert the cash to gold, hang on to the gold will continue to appreciate with the inflation. When the market bubble breaks, the prices of houses will collapse. When it collapses, then you come back into the marketplace. When rents are less than the price of the house, but it takes cash to get into the house, and you're sitting here cash rich. Now you take the cash and you go out and buy a house, two houses, three houses. I've seen people multiply their house position from one house to 40 houses in 10 years. And you do it by geometric progression. Now I teach a business school, and I want to suggest to you that you go to my webpage and look at the webpage and the schools that we offer, and then be sure to write for my free general law CD package. And let me tell you about business school, because business is where we make money. Now I told you in the first program in this series about a guy named Ed Beltram, B-E-L-T-R-A-M. Go back to lesson one, or go back to the first program in this series, Sunday's program, and take a look here at this guy, Ed Beltram. He's working for $7.50 an hour. Boys and girls, $7.50 an hour is the kind of work that belongs to a teenager going to school flipping burgers down at Burger King or something. That's not for adults. Evidently, this guy doesn't know how to make money. If he knew how to make money, I guess he'd be out making money. I wouldn't get out of bed for $7.50 an hour. I don't have any friends, and I don't know of anybody that would get out of bed for $7.50 an hour. Because the money, boys and girls, is made in business. The money is made in buying, selling, and trading. The money is made when you take $1,000 and you go out and buy something for $1,000, do something to it, and sell it for $2,000. Hell, it could be an automobile. I've told this story a time or two. Let me share with you a story in business. This is the way you do automobiles. I had a student one time that was laid off. Well, he wasn't laid off. I should take that back. He actually took early retirement. He was going to be laid off, but before he was laid off, Crown Zillerback said, well, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll give you this early retirement, and you can draw your pension. So Wally said, well, shucks, I guess I better do that. So at age 55, he took his early retirement. 3 years later, at age 58, just exactly what happened to this guy, Ed Beltram. Crown Zillerback cuts off the pension program, and he and his wife are living in Orlando, Florida, you know, just living from hand to mouth on his pension down here, trying to make ends meet, and the pension gets shut off. Well, Wally, he said, well, now what am I going to do? So he starts selling stuff. Well, he had a Ford Pinto automobile, and he thought it was worth about $1,200. So he went down to a laundromat, and he put up a little sign down there on the bulletin board, and it said, Pinto automobile, $1,200. Well, a few days later, some guy comes along and pays Wally $1,200 for this Pinto car. You know, Wally needs the money to pay the rent and buy food. He doesn't know what the hell he's going to do for the future. He's 58. How in the hell is he going to get a job? Well, he isn't going to get a job in corporate America. So anyway, he's got the $1,200, and calls are still coming in off the sign. So he says to Mary, he says, I'm going down to take that sign off the bulletin board, Mary. He goes down there to take the sign off the bulletin board, and on the same bulletin board is another sign for a Ford Pinto automobile for $1,500. And Wally's kind of curious. And he says, geez, I wonder if I sold my car too cheap, or I wonder if that car is better than mine. And so on a lark, he took his sign down, took this other guy's sign down. He goes out to this guy's house, and he looks at the guy's car. It's a better car than his. He wanted $1,500 for it. Wally on a lark offered him $1,000 cash. He had the money in his pocket. And the guy took it. So he bought the second Pinto automobile for $1,500. Well, he bought it for $1,000, but he turned around, and he sold it for $1,500. He actually made a profit on his very first automobile transaction. Encouraged now, he started looking in the Thrifty Nickel and other places for automobiles, and he started buying automobiles. He'd do maybe one a month, and it really helped. You know, Wally and Mary, you know, they were making, you know, $400 or $500 a month. They'd buy a car, and he'd fix it up and paint underneath the hood. He showed me how he did that. He got some spray paint, and he sprayed under the hood, and he'd put new spark plug wires on and new spark plugs in it, make it look real, real nice, clean it up real good, and then advertise it for sale. He put in a little spit and polish, a little elbow grease, and by golly, he'd sell the car. He'd make $200, $300, $400, $500. Pretty soon, he's selling one a week. Pretty soon, his wife is scurrying around, and she's looking at all the want ads and giving them to Wally and calling all of these people, making appointments, and Wally is going out and test driving automobiles, and he's buying and selling automobiles. He has no license. He has no overhead. He has no expenses. He isn't licensed, bonded, or insured, and he's selling a car a week. Well, isn't that just real special? Well, that's 52 cars a month. Now, if he can make $300 a car times 52, that's $15,600 a year. Well, boys and girls, $15,600 back in the 70s and 80s was pretty good money. It was equal to double that today. I just want to point out that before I would work for $7.50 an hour, I think I'd go out and buy and sell cars or motorcycles or boats. You know, the government is constantly seizing people's drug paraphernalia, like their boats and cars and airplanes and things like that, and they auction them off. And they go for pretty reasonable prices a lot of times. There are deals out there, boys and girls, and as I point out in my business school, that opportunity is like rain. Opportunity is everywhere, all of the time. I don't know who thunk up the idea that opportunity only knocks once. That had to be some bondservant employee, a credit debt serf slave someplace. That isn't where an entrepreneur lives. That isn't where an entrepreneur breathes. An entrepreneur will make money when there's boom times, and he will make money when there's bust times. Some of the biggest profits, some of the best deals will be made at the bottom of the next depression. There's no reason to fear the depression. It's a grand opportunity to take advantage of all of the people who are losing their property, losing their cars and motorcycles. I just saw an ad the other day on national TV. It's Fannie Mae and a big mortgage company. I forgot the name of this big mortgage company now, but they advertise on TV quite often, and they're advertising foreclosed on real property, real estate, houses. People are beginning to lose their houses. This isn't the time to be buying the houses. This is just the beginning of the collapse. We want to wait for the bottom to maximize our profit. No, I tell you, boys and girls, there's nothing more exciting than business. If there is, I don't know what it is. Sure as hell ain't sex. I never got as big a kick flying an airplane under the Golden Gate Bridge as I do in buying, selling, and trading. You know, when I was a kid, I had eternal life. I used to fly airplanes under bridges and power lines. Today, I quit flying. Now I concentrate on business. And if you'd like to learn more about business, why don't you call and ask for my free general law CD package? And let me tell you about business. In fact, the worst time to make money is in boom times, like right now at the peak. This is where business really slacks off. You know, you're already at the top. There aren't any profits to be made in real estate today. Well, I shouldn't say there aren't any. There's still a few deals running around, but they're very few and far between. You just wait. In 24 to 36 months, there'll be so many real estate deals out there, we won't be able to keep up with them. And I mean good ones that make good profits. Hey, I'm out of time. We'll be back here tomorrow night talking about the same thing. This thing of your retirement. Is your retirement at risk? You bet it is. But profits are there to take its place. All right, you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. The law school teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law and agricultural law, civil rights and biblical law from a scriptural perspective. Remember that The Law Hour is carried worldwide over the Internet. All of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and The Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. That's it. Time's up. I got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station, God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, and good night, friends.